Montpelier braces for a tight budget year as uncertainty over federal funding persists. Plus, state leaders eye general funds to buy down property taxes again, and farmers look to the legislature for help as they contend with devastating impacts of drought. All that and more ahead on Vermont This Week.
From the Vermont Public Studio in Winooski, this is Vermont This Week. Made possible in part by the Lintelak Foundation and Milne Travel. Here's moderator Mitch Wertlieb.
Thanks everyone for joining us today. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Friday, January 23rd. And today on the panel with us, we have Mark Johnson from WCAX, Austin Gaffney from VT Digger, and joining us remotely today, Peter Hirschfeld from Vermont Public. Thank you all so much for being here. And we're going to start with the big news, of course, this week that the budget address was given by Governor Phil Scott. Pete Hirschfeld, of course, you were there attending and listening to everything. And I guess the good news is that state revenue projections have been unchanged from July. No downgrade of projected revenue coming to the state of Vermont. However, a lot of uncertainty, and everyone is saying it's going to be a tight budget year. How can those two things be the same at once?
You know, Mitch, actually, there technically was a downgrade, and administration officials say that's notable. It wasn't a statistically significant downgrade, but the general fund is forecast to get $9 million less in revenue in fiscal year 27 than the previous estimate. And administration officials say that's the first time since 2017 that Vermont has seen a downgrade. And it sort of signals for a lot of people the potential that Vermont might encounter economic headwinds after this period of historic revenue growth that it's enjoyed over the past half decade or so. Governor Scott made very clear to lawmakers the budget that you're going to be putting together this year, the budget that I'm presenting to you, is going to be a lot different than the one that you're used to precisely because of that revenue situation. And as we've seen state spending go from $6.5-ish billion 5 years ago to over $9 billion today, he made it very clear those days of that sort of rapid growth are over.
And he's proposing about a $9.4 billion budget. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's about a 3% spending increase over this year's $9.1 billion budget. Does not have the laundry list of one-time initiatives using one-time money that we've seen in previous years. And the decisions that lawmakers have about what they're going to spend money on, and more importantly, in some cases, what they're not going to be able to spend money on, are going to be a lot more difficult this year.
Mark Johnson, what did you think about the sort of the tenor of the speech, what the governor was saying? Any surprises there for you?
Well, a couple of surprises. I mean, that number that Pete just cited is just incredible. I mean, the growth in the state budget just in the past 5 years, you know, I was thinking, wow, you know, $9 billion. And I think what's really significant and important about that is about a third of the money comes from the feds. And given what's going on down in Washington these days with cutbacks being made down there, and I think another huge factor is that we don't have Pat Leahy anymore sitting down in Washington as the chair of the Appropriations Committee. You know, in these kind of situations in the past, he was able to get these earmarks or bills passed, you know, slide a million here, a couple of million there. And, you know, Vermont doesn't have him sitting down there anymore. So I really think, you know, I watched the speech and I thought, wow, what a challenge here. You know, you've got a governor who, you know, nobody wants to see taxes raised. And, you know, times are tight for everybody. We've got this, you know, huge healthcare crisis going on with an awful lot of people losing their health insurance. You know, people are really struggling out there. And at the same time, there are all these demands out there. And the inflation numbers in the past 5 years have been 20 to 25%. So even without doing anything else, the cost of goods and services has just gone up. So, you know, and the other thing that struck me is that I heard a lot of people after the speech, you know, Senator Philip Baruth came up with this idea of trying to cap education spending. But, you know, there was a lot of, well, that's not really what we want to hear. This is Band-Aids. And I thought to myself, well, you know, you got to try something, you know, particularly on this education proposal. Clearly, what we're doing now doesn't seem to be really working. I mean, the cost in education, which is, you know, another third of the budget here, 28% of the budget, So, you know, this is a Rubik's Cube that seems like it's going to be a real challenge to figure out.
That's a good way of describing it, like a Rubik's Cube, and we're nowhere near getting all the sides to, you know, match up the way they should. Pete, I want to sort of riff off of what Mark was just saying there, especially about that proposed education spending cap bill that the pro tem is floating there. What are the specifics of that? Apparently, Governor Phil Scott is on board with it. He likes Phil Baruth's idea on this, right?
He does like Phil Baruth's idea, I think in part because a lot of lawmakers are beginning to come to grips with the fact that this historic education reform law that they passed last year is not going to be taking effect nearly as quickly as they hoped, if at all, frankly, depending on how the conversation over forced mergers for school districts goes this year. And so that has increased the urgency for a shorter-term cost containment mechanism. What Phil Baruth is proposing is called an allowable spending growth cap, and it would, the impact would be different district to district. If you're a low-spending district, you could spend as much as 9% more in the following year's budget. If you're a high-spending district, your allowable growth could be capped at 2%. There are a lot of people in the education community that say history has proven that these sorts of mechanisms do not work, that they lead to perverse incentives that can actually compel districts to increase spending beyond what they would spend anyway. But there's near unanimity in Montpelier right now that the spending problem in education is one that needs to be addressed now. And what that solution looks like is going to be the subject of a lot of hand-wringing over the next few weeks and months.
Yeah, it certainly is going to be. And to Mark's point, when we're talking about the tax issue and what people can afford, property taxes, we know we've talked about it so much on this program, we have to talk about it again today, is a big issue. What we're doing, what we're seeing now, $150 million in a property tax buy-down, that's just to get the property taxes from 12% to about 6%. But Mark, when we're talking about what you were saying, like a third of the budget being, you know, federal money, we just don't know what's going to happen with that money, right? So what are we looking at here? What are some of the risks that are associated with that?
Well, you don't know on any given day what's going to happen. So in the past, at least when the feds made cutbacks, you could plan on them. But, you know, really, you could wake up tomorrow morning and Congress and the president could decide they're going to flatline X, Y, or Z. So, you know, this $70 million, I think it is, that they've put aside for that, boy, that just seems really dicey that that's going to be enough to be provide any sort of a buffer. You know, I mean, these are could be anything from, you know, school lunch programs, SNAP benefits. I mean, you know, the list kind of just goes on and on. I mean, I think the big one is the healthcare subsidies. I mean,
Medicaid,
when you've got people that are, you know, working people that are, we're paying $800 a month in premiums, which is still a lot, and now that's going to go to $1,700 a month. I mean, that's just breathtaking. And there doesn't seem to be any further discussion about changing that. So, you know, the federal government is just this wild card in all of this that is completely undependable.
$70 million, Pete, that Mark Johnson was just mentioning there, that's been set aside for the loss of potential federal funding, right? But here's what I'm wondering about. We're already spending the $115 million this year to buy down the property tax burden. That happened last year as well, millions of dollars to buy down that again. Eventually, this money's going to run out, right? I mean, where is that $70 million coming from? Is there money beyond that? What do we know about that?
So there is no money beyond that $70 million as of right now. There are other reserve funds that the legislature could theoretically dip into, but those are sort of break glass in case of emergency reserves. And this is why there is some real consternation among Democratic lawmakers to use this $115 million that Phil Scott is talking about to buy down property tax bills for a couple reasons. A, this federal issue we're talking about, where who knows what might happen and what sort of capacity Vermont might need to offset that. But this 12% on average increase in property tax bills that Vermonters are going to see this year if the legislature does nothing, half of that, 6%, is because lawmakers used one-time money to buy down property tax bills last year. If they do that again, if they do what the governor is proposing, then what you're looking at during next year's property taxes is a built-in 12% increase, because that one-time money will not be there anymore to buy down those rates. And so, you know, lawmakers are contending with the urgency of this immediate problem and understanding that if they act in the only obvious way that they have, they stand to make things a whole lot worse in the future.
Yeah, it's really just pushing the problem further and further down the road every year. Pete, you know, I was wondering why the governor put that proposal out now as opposed to waiting a little bit and trying to, you know, turn up the heat on his education reform proposal.
It's fascinating to me, too, Mark. You would think that one possible strategy politically would be let Vermonters feel the full force of these property tax increases, assume that they're going to blame the Democratic legislature for it, and voila, maybe you've got a Republican majority in the Senate next year and a far slimmer majority in the House, right? I think what is also true is that there are more and more Vermonters who are getting to a point where they literally cannot afford to pay their property taxes, right? And a concern that you're going to start to see delinquencies. And I think there's a sense that the financial cost to taxpayers is just so far beyond what many of them can afford that you sort of have to do this.
Yeah, and if you did what you're talking about in the political situation, Pete, let's say that blame did go towards the Democratic lawmakers in that sort of worst case 12% property tax scenario, eventually the Republican Party would have to come up with a solution, right? I mean, voters are not going to be able to just say, okay, you know, that you've got to come up with a solution one way or the other.
Yeah, and as it turns out, achieving or ensuring short-term reduction in the rise of growth in education spending, it's hard to do it in ways that don't become draconian for certain school districts in the system that we have right now. And there's real fears that a arbitrary mandatory cap on spending is going to do things to districts that they might not be able to recover from. Simultaneously, they've got to do something about the cost of education. So their choices are really limited.
Yeah. All right. The governor drilled down on some other topics as well. Austin Gaffney, one of the things he was talking about was pushing back against the Global Warming Solutions Act. And he actually brought up something that we haven't heard about in a while, sort of pushing the idea of nuclear energy again, right?
Yeah, so he touched on energy affordability also in his budget address, which has been an issue in Vermont for a while. Vermont has one of the nation's highest energy burdens in the country, which means a lot of people spend a lot of their income on electricity. So what he is proposing is actually a bill that would change what is called the Renewable Energy Standard to a Clean Energy Standard. So instead of forcing the state to meet a requirement of 100% renewable energy by 2030 or 2035, depending on what utility you are, the Clean Energy Standard would include zero emissions types of energy, which would include nuclear. Yeah.
So one of those things about emissions that brings up the transportation fund as well, Pete, right? And we're looking at a bit of a shortfall there. That's another concern, yes?
A real concern, and one that lawmakers have been worried about for years, but feel like the time is coming when they're going to have to reckon with it. There's a $33 million deficit in next year's transportation fund. Phil Scott is proposing resolving that by redirecting $10 million in purchase and use revenue that currently goes from the transportation fund to the education fund. Of course, that means you're taking it from the education fund, which only adds to the property tax pressure that we just spent so much time talking about. The rest of that deficit will be resolved with internal savings at the Agency of Transportation that involve the elimination of 31 jobs there, 19 of which are currently filled. So those are people that would be losing the jobs that they have right now. There's sort of a building chorus in the legislature that the transportation fund requires a more structural solution that involves looking at the revenue side, i.e. the gas tax, which Phil Scott made very clear he's not interested in even considering. I think there's a real chance that perhaps not this year, but maybe next year, you begin to see possibly a bipartisan coalition of people saying, look, we're not going to be able to solve this problem in our transportation fund if we don't rectify the imbalance between revenues and costs. And in order to do that, we're going to have to raise taxes.
Well, there's another potential issue here, and it's one that everybody can relate to in the state of Vermont. Austin Gaffney, you were writing about this in VT Digger, and that was last year's devastating droughts for farmers. Now, they would love to see a reserve fund created, which would bring about how much money to farmers? Again, this would be money coming, I'm assuming, from the state to help farmers out?
Yeah, it's called a Farm Security Fund. They pushed it last year after 2 years of floods. They've pushed it again this year after last year's drought. Certain advocacy groups like NOFA VT will say that, you know, $20 million is the minimum that farmers would need.
The minimum.
Yeah. Other groups are saying, you know, $1 million is all that the state can afford. So this year, we know that the droughts cost at least $15.9 million for farmers, according to a preliminary state survey. So that is basically equal to what both the 2023 and 2024 floods also cost the state.
Would this be money that would be available for farmers annually if this went through?
The idea is that it would be an annual appropriation, but whether or not that will be passed as an annual appropriation would remain to be seen.
This
is a classic case where if Senator Leahy were down there, he would be carving out money. And, you know, when you have a federal budget as opposed to the state budget, a couple of million here, a couple of million there, and, you know, Bob's your uncle.
Yeah, you make it sound so easy, but, you know, again, you're right.
You're just dealing with a much larger pool of money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what they're talking about here in Vermont. You know, one of the things, getting back to the governor's speech, that I was a little surprised he didn't talk about, there was no mention of tourism and this challenge that's going on with so many fewer Canadians coming down. And I thought, you know, it might have made sense for him to acknowledge that, give a head nod to that, and maybe there's an effort somewhere there to try to boost that. Because there really, when you come down to it, are very few big sources of new revenue or additional revenue. And that seemed to be one area that was could have been touched on.
Yeah, I want to talk about another area, too, that the governor did not talk about in the speech. But first, getting back to the drought fund here, Austin Gaffney, there was something interesting in that proposal, which was to remove the word climate from that. Why?
Yeah, there was an amendment added to this proposal recently to exchange the word climate for weather in a lot of the references within the bill. One of the state's lawyers said the reason for that was just to basically avoid controversy once this bill goes back to the Senate. You know, I think it's one of the first signals we're having in Vermont of this kind of climate denial language. I have not been here as long as you all have to know whether or not this has been something that's happened in the past, but this is the first time I've seen that kind of language removed from a bill.
Pete and Mark, I want you to talk about that for a second, because I understand wanting to avoid that word on a federal level. We all know how the Trump administration feels about climate change, thinks it's a hoax. Why here on the state level?
I think you just answered the question. I think that if you're looking to get federal help for something like that, you want to remove that language. It's a little bit like the whole, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. You don't want to be including that if you have anything that you want to get in education or in any other area.
Yeah, but there's been no evidence that placating the Trump administration on things like this is going to get you any favor.
Well, and you know, Phil Scott touched on that right at the top of his speech this week. He said, you know, no amount of rhetoric is going to change what's going to happen out of Washington. You know, on the other hand, a little bit of rhetoric can also signal to at least people here in Vermont that you are acknowledging the problem. It may not change anything, but, you know, Phil Scott has come under fair amount of criticism, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong here, you know, of not pushing back hard enough sometimes when the feds are doing what they're doing. So, you know, that really stood out to me this week, right off the top of this speech, for him to say, you know, anything we say here in Vermont isn't going to change what the feds do.
And rhetoric does change things from time to time, right? We just celebrated the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. this week. And I think it's hard to argue that his rhetoric didn't lead to material change in the course of this country. Phil Scott has resisted since the beginning of the second Trump term a more aggressive and hostile approach to things that he's seen from Washington that he acknowledges he disagrees with. And there are a lot of Vermonters. There was a press conference in the State House this week where lawmakers were just expressing confusion and exasperation that he wouldn't have used either his State of the State address or his budget address to at least mention what's going on as it relates to immigration enforcement in Vermont and the rest of the country. Obviously, he's come to the conclusion that that's not the most strategic tack to take right now.
Well, what's going on in the state of Minnesota, of course, has captured national attention. There's talk of a kind of general strike there over what has happened with some of the incidents with ICE in that state. ICE is now going to the state of Maine. You know, we don't know what's going to happen here eventually, but we do know, Austin Gaffney, that there were some protests planned for this weekend about an ICE facility in Williston. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there are two ICE facilities in Williston. They're less than 2 miles from each other across Highway 2. They've been the target of anti-ICE activism since November. They're both in charge of, one is in charge of investigations with surveillance. The other hosts a national tip line for ICE. So while there has been noise demonstrations, there's been banner drops, there's been marches, not much has changed about the work that happens inside those facilities. But the town of Williston has taken basically a symbolic stand this week. The town select board on Tuesday passed a resolution that says they oppose the enforcement and surveillance actions of ICE. That is the first town that we know of in the state of Vermont to have passed such a resolution, but that resolution is now being passed amongst towns. So we'll see if it gets picked up anywhere else.
And they did that knowing that it's symbolic. They know that there's no actual real teeth there. But, you know, maybe to Pete's point and to Mark's point, you know, that does that rhetoric maybe matters, at least to town officials in Williston.
Yeah, exactly. There is no teeth, as you said, to this kind of resolution. But I think it is addressing sort of the activism and the frustration that a lot of Vermonters have had with actions by ICE, both on a national level and with their presence in the state. I think it will be really interesting to watch what happens with, I think it's called Operation Catch and Release in Maine, and see how some of those impacts could trickle down here to Vermont. So I think it remains to be seen what kind of actions the state takes, but I think these kind of more local, symbolic actions really mean a lot to the people in the town, even if there's no change that springs from it.
And go ahead, Mark.
Pete mentioned Martin Luther King, and I know we're going to talk about Bernie Sanders in a moment. And all I could think of when you talk about, you know, does rhetoric matter? I think Bernie Sanders would argue quite strongly that rhetoric matters. You know, him talking about the wealth gap, the inequality in this country, you know, the complete corruption of the electoral system, the, you know, losing Citizens United and how campaigns are funded, you know, the disastrous state of the for-profit healthcare industry in this country. I think he would argue quite strenuously that, you know, rhetoric matters a heck of a lot.
Yeah, and we're going to be seeing a lot of these issues, you know, come to the fore sooner rather than later. The ICE facilities in Williston, Austin, very, very quickly, these are data gathering facilities. What are they doing there? What are people protesting about?
Yeah, largely, as we understand it, they are data gathering facilities. So there is one on Industrial Avenue in the White Cat Business Park. As far as we understand, that is, again, investigating online surveillance. So looking at open source information and now, I think, digging more into social media. In October, there was a work order for that facility hiring about a dozen more people. So it's been there for a while, and what we know is that it is expanding. The other facility on Harvest Lane, again, functions as basically a national tip line while doing other actions. And again, it has been there before the second Trump administration came into office.
And Pete Hirschfeld, to your point that you were making before, were there sort of rumblings that you were hearing after the governor's speech about him not mentioning ICE enforcement, about him not mentioning some of the things that are happening nationally?
Yeah, certainly. There are people in the State House and around Vermont that are looking for him to make a more forceful stand against the administration, much like he did, we should note, during the first Trump administration, right? I mean, Phil Scott was somebody who was calling on the president to resign at one point or to have Congress remove him. So there are a lot of lawmakers and Vermonters who wish they were hearing more of that tone from him now.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering if the reason he's not doing that is, again, thinking that some of that federal money is going to be needed. So we have to sort of make sure we're you know, not pressing the wrong buttons in that way. But, Mark, as you were saying, that has not proven to be any kind of a salve at this point.
Well, I mean, you know, I understand the logic of what he's saying, too, which is you keep yourself off the radar. I mean, the louder you are, the harsher the penalty seems to be.
Yeah, but we're going to have to be, we're going to have a lot of these problems again coming to the fore in the next few months. So we'll see what happens there. Mark, you were mentioning Bernie Sanders, and I know that on your podcast, 802 News, you recently spoke with Dan Chazen, who wrote a new book about Bernie. It's called Bernie in Burlington, is that right?
Bernie for Burlington.
Bernie for Burlington.
Yep. Which was the first slogan that he had when he won the mayoral race in 1981. This is a really fascinating book. It's part memoir of Dan, who grew up in Burlington. He was 9 years old when Bernie was first elected in 1981. But it really, I think, is the most comprehensive book that traces Bernie's initial arrival in Vermont, 1964, and then again in 1968. Dan was able to get interviews with some people. It was just incredible. He spent an awful lot of time with Bernie's older brother, Larry, some real insiders in Burlington that really none of us have talked to at the kind of depth that he has. And I think, he's a poet, but he may have gotten more out of these sources than a journalist showing up and saying, hi, I'm from the Washington Post.
Check it out on the 802 News podcast. I want to thank our panel so much today. We had Mark Johnson with us from WCAX and Pete Hirschfeld remotely from Montpelier from Vermont Public and Austin Gaffney with VT Digger. I'm Mitch Wortley. Go Patriots. I think they're going to win by 3 this weekend. I hope you'll join us again next week for Vermont This Week.